only those things which have in themselves, presumably, some serious meaning. But let us not remove fiction as a possible means of education, inasmuch as fiction, arising directly from imagination in man, sometimes carries the most powerful of all moral fables, carries in many instances a greater dynamic than prose, or than history or philosophy. The same is true of poetry, which may be more truthful than theology, simply because poetry represents a release, not bounded or held by certain censorship of the reason. Therefore, speaking more directly from the internal instincts, impulses, and intuitions of the individual. On the more serious side of reading, however, we know a little now about what our instruments are, what our problem is, and how each individual must be presumed to be able to solve it. The first thing that every reader must try to do to the best of his ability is to recover from this instinct of perpetual acceptance by automatic or autonomic procedure within himself. This problem of simply reading and reacting merely to words. He must, if he wishes to read profitably, he must try to experience reading in terms of the total consciousness of himself. For example, in recent years, speed reading has developed, in which an individual is able to skim a book almost in an incredibly short period of time. What the advantage is, other than perhaps in book reviewing or in something of that nature, is not quite clear, because skim reading only makes the problem more superficial than it was before. Opposed to this is digesting, or the effort to extract from long and complicated works their essence, meaning, or substance, and placing this in a brief statement, making it directly available to the individual. This has some merits, for the reason that the average person's continuity is not great enough to perpetuate a very long chain of related sequences without the chain breaking somewhere. He just does not have this type of recollectingness within himself. So digesting may have merit. It may have certain limitations also. But it points out the important fact that if we cannot learn all that is contained in a work, it is better that we learn something clearly and definitely than to skim over much and retain little. So very often in digesting, we strive for the keynotes or the high points of a long and difficult article, and in this way make it available to the average person of restricted time and interest. These things will all do a great deal to influence modern reading. And modern reading today is in need of considerable influencing, because it is largely indiscriminate. It is largely a reading according to fashion. It is a reading for pleasure rather than learning. It is a reading largely of escape literature at a time when man should not be thinking as much of escape as he is of solution. So a lot of reading is not really intended to profit the person. And wonderful or strange as it may seem, unprofitable reading may have the greatest basic influence upon the individual. He may actually be more moved by the detective story than he is by a wide selection of learned and important works. The reason being that he has approached the detective story almost without prejudice, in a highly relaxed state, and is simply waiting to be entertained. This places him in a particularly receptive situation. Whereas with a serious book, he is apt to approach it with prejudices, with restrictions, with fears, with doubts, misgivings concerning his own ability, and gradually perhaps develop an inferiority complex as he passes from page 3 to page 4. He no longer trusts himself after he listens or mentally hears a number of long words for which he has no adequate definition. All of these things influence reading habits and reading practices. Reading cannot be and must not be a substitute for living. No individual can read so much that its total will ever equal experience. Actually, reading is to supplement, to fill in, to help the individual, because none of us can experience everything. But the moment reading becomes so heavy a practice, as it does with some people who are very studious and very well intentioned, that life becomes a vicarious existence bounded on every side by a book. If this happens, the whole character, the whole purpose of the individual is frustrated. Thus, reading is not a substitute for living. It is not a substitute for the apprenticeship of doing. It is not a substitute for the sharing of ideas between living persons, nor is it a sure and inevitable solution to the reasonable doubt within yourself. Reading is therefore a useful auxiliary. But where it is accepted as a basis of ultimate solution to something, it is likely to prove most disappointing. Actually, many very solid thinkers in this field have taken the attitude that man should read primarily only in order to gain some information about facts or about circumstances that cannot be directly experienced by the person. The individual who cannot go to the place may read about it. But though he read about it for 20 years, he will not gain as full an estimation of that place as he would by an actual residence there for a few hours. There is the difference between the vicarious and the impact of the actual thing upon the complicated sensory mechanism of the individual. Reading does not use all of the sensory perceptions. It does not call into being the total consciousness assets of man. Therefore, it cannot result in a total vitalization of his nature. Now, reading, under discretion and discrimination, may impel the individual to an experience. The person who has read much and long about the beauties and wonders of the Mediterranean islands may finally gain so strong an impulse that he insists upon going there. When he gets there, he finds that his reading has helped him, that it has helped to make this beautiful region more understandable to him. And he begins to recollect what he read about this place or what he read about that place. And each of these places becomes more important, more living, because he is able to place them in a reference frame that is adequate. So reading supplies forever this reference frame which will enrich the individual when he actually creates a factual experience situation. Always then, we must think of reading in its ability to create reference frames, that it should impel us always to action, never merely to the continuance of reading. In philosophy, reading of some important basic text should lead us to conviction, which is a kind of internal action. It should cause us to examine our own conviction, which is again an activity. It should help us to apply censorship upon our own errors, again an action. And if the reading proves to have been correct, and the recommendations were right and practical, the individual should experience improvement and should sense that he is better equipped for life and action. Then he can call upon this experience from within himself in need, but he cannot call directly upon words and find any consolation in them. He cannot meet problem with words when this problem presents itself factually. Therefore, all words must be transmuted into living force within his own consciousness if they are to be useful to him in any emergency. This means that for the most part, we should read more slowly. Read less, but read carefully. That the advantage is not how many books we have read. The advantage lies in what we have been able to use, what we have been able to make our own through a positive process of assimilation, so that actually these words have become like the food that we eat. We are not nourished by the food, but by a certain vitality or vitamin within the food. We are not nourished by the words of our authors, but by a certain vitality, which if we can assimilate it and can make it part of a living knowledge in ourselves, may be available to us when we need it most. Therefore, the proof of learning is the availability of sufficiency in time of stress. And unless this availability is there, the learning has been without profit or merit. Now, all of us are in the same position or condition that De Quincey was in the British Museum when he sat weeping at the reader's table. He was surrounded by them by more than 4 million books, and he knew that he could not live long enough to read them all. He knew that no matter how careful, how thoughtful he was, he would not be able to share in the experiences of all these different persons whose lives, whose attitudes, whose convictions, whose discoveries were recorded in this immense body of literature. Therefore, De Quincey concluded, as we must all conclude, that a certain censorship must be applied. That we cannot read all means that we must try to select that which is most useful, that which perhaps in one way or another is most applicable to our own profit. This calls for another development within our natures. Before we can know what kind of reading can serve us best, we must also know what is our greatest need. We cannot afford to take the time of reading 100 books by the hope that one of them will help. We cannot afford this process of letting the book tell us what we need. We must have certain fields of need, certain recognized problems in their various orders of importance. And all things being equal, we must seek first that information which, if first achieved, will make the most immediate attainment in our lives or solve the most pressing problem. This means discrimination, organization of our own requirements, the recognition of our own weaknesses, the understanding of our own shortcomings, so that we can select honestly and properly. Once we have decided by discrimination this particular issue, we then search for such literature as may have a bearing upon it. Now, how do we search for it? There are several ways. One of scholarship's most natural and common methods is by a certain form of detective procedure. Research programs and each individual searching for the answer to a problem of his own becomes, in this searching, a research student. Each researcher takes hold of a simple thread and follows this thread through a labyrinth of complicated relationships. He finds, for example, that if he approaches a standard text upon his subject, that this standard text will be documented. As he reads through, he will find notes and footnotes. And he will find that in the paragraph relating to his problem, there will nearly always be a quotation or a note that this particular paragraph was derived from or based upon the works of a certain person. Or perhaps even more than this, the reader will be invited to consider a larger and fuller statement by someone else or in some other place. The reader then follows this, securing, if possible, the work referred to, and will learn that this work was the product of several persons perhaps working together, or arising at a certain time in the mental or intellectual life of the author, and that he in turn has enlarged upon this problem, and that he was brought first to its attention or came first interested in it as the result of still another person whose name is now mentioned perhaps for the first time. And so by degrees we trace through the origin of the idea until we find out where it began, how it developed, and how the treatment that we know came into existence. In this procedure, we gradually get hold of all of the elements of an hypothesis, which in its original statement in the one popular book that we read may have had 5 lines, leaving us hopeful but confused. Actually, as a result of a careful program of study, we can trace these lines and their thoughts and their substances. And if we trace them far enough, likely as not, we shall trace them to one of the half dozen basic sources of ideas in the world. We will find that these ideas were developed from, unfolded from, enriched from, and sometimes misrepresented from one of these earlier texts. And as we go back on and on in our searching, we may very well gradually discover that practically everything that we know in Western knowledge, practically every important idea that we have, is traceable to maybe only a handful of basic thinkers. And that of these basic thinkers, the outstanding and most commonly referred to is Plato. Emerson came to that discovery when he realized and stated that all Western knowledge is merely Plato interpreted or misinterpreted. And this is essentially a truth. But out of our general study, perhaps over a period of 3 or 4 years, maybe a little longer, or if we're very, very clever at our technical approach to things, perhaps less, we will gradually sort out secondary and tertiary sources. We will begin to realize that most writers are more or less beggars who have built their writings from the crumbs from the great men's tables. We will learn that the great authorities have merely been restated, reinterpreted, and usually to a degree mutilated. And that so many books are not basic. They do not really represent the wisdom of the author, but merely his compiling skill from other sources of information. Now, his compiling skill may be worth something because it may assist us in seeing more clearly and more immediately something that would be deep, mysterious, and diffused through the writings of an earlier person. But little by little, we begin to recognize the importance of basic sources. Basic sources for the average Western man must, however, come into English before he can handle them. If he has other languages, he may be able to go behind the English. But for the most part, he must depend upon English versions of basic works. Here, various scholarships and recommendations along the way may assist him in the selection of the best available version in English of some noted and important original. And then, having finally come back by degrees to his source material, the reader must roll up his sleeves, settle back, and say, "This I must attack. I can no longer depend upon the 25-cent digest, I can no longer depend upon the modern philosophical historian who writes me a chatty little story about Leibniz but tells me nothing essentially of what this man believed or why he believed it. So having found an intriguing subject, we must go back to the labor of source. And if we do not do that, we are most certainly ultimately mutilate our author. We will come to conclusions inconsistent with him. Now, another thing we find is that perhaps in our searching, we are searching for only a single thing. Perhaps in our reading, we are trying to prove that great persons through the ages held a belief which we regard to be valid. So we will quote and look for quotations from these persons, and we will carefully go through an elaborate work, noting nothing except that which bears particularly upon our point of interest. This is exceedingly dangerous and leads to an immediate eclecticism. It is dangerous because an author's statement, if he is a valid writer, is always as the consequence and result of a general pattern. He is thinking from a large total concept. And if this total concept is not understood, his isolated thoughts will not be consistent, nor will they represent him. So our idea must be oriented in its larger concept. Otherwise, we may misquote the meaning of our author, even while we correctly quote his words. This is due, again, to the interval between thoughts and words, and the fact that words mean what they mean to the one who uses them, and therefore may have a totally different meaning for Leibniz than the meaning they might have for Immanuel Kant. Thus, we cannot merely quote words or accept sentences. We must work with total concepts, and in these things we can also, to a great degree, have help. Because while these concepts might take years for us to analyze in their totality, there are basic texts in which these concepts are reduced to their essentials, in which we can study them with comparative clarity and ease. Thus we trace, follow, examine, and find in that way that reading becomes purposeful. We are not reading, jogging along, hoping we will find an idea, or hoping that this author has a better answer than that author for some problem that perturbs us. We are reading purposefully to determine the relationship of ideas, to prove or disprove, to strengthen or weaken essential concepts or patterns which have either inspired us to search for greater wisdom or so annoyed us that we must ultimately prove them to be untrue. These different attitudes all affect the reader and his reading. Today, the library has almost disappeared from the average American home. With it has gone those grand old monuments to ancestral literary tastes, such as the Complete Dickens, the Complete Thackeray, and the Complete Scott. These things have gone. In their place today, instead of the family gathering around the literary work, it gathers around the television or the radio or is out riding on the country or city roads bumper to bumper with the neighbor. This situation has had considerable effect upon reading tastes. Reading is not as easy to us as it used to be. We find this disruption and interruption much easier. And because we have read less, we have lost a considerable amount of our own literary taste. Today, the average person does not use words either well or pleasantly. He has lost the gentle art of conversation. He has lost the ability to be interesting to himself or anyone else without three or four cocktails. Until he has unbridled his libido with alcoholic nutrition, he is unable to express himself. He is unable to simply share in a common interest of ideas. This is unfortunate because it has reduced our ability to gain through literal and factual interchange of ideas. And it has driven the student further and further into his book, and has made reading a difficult habit for an individual of the average walk of life who has not been trained in its use. He no longer understands it. He no longer finds joy and release in it. He no longer finds immediate self-improvement in it. Therefore, his instincts have weakened gradually until they have become rather feeble in a great many instances. Now, let us imagine that as students of these various important subjects, that you would like to think in terms of a reading program, that how to use the book to help your mind to use its own faculties and functions more clearly. Remember, of course, that the mind, like every instrument of the body, is strengthened by use, and that there is a very great deal of difference between strengthening thought and strengthening memory. To strengthen memory, we just have to keep on remembering. That's what does it. But to strengthen thought, we have to keep on thinking. And that's a little more difficult. Especially when the world is constantly trying to do our thinking for us, as through propaganda and salesmanship, in which little by little policies are forced upon us, attitudes are required or demanded of us, until the individual's individuality is almost totally submerged. A thinker must be an individual. He must have certain faith and confidence in his own ability to reason. And he must have some proof occasionally that his ability is genuine. The reasonable things which he decides to do must be reasonable when they are done. They must prove themselves, justify themselves, and sustain themselves in action. But assuming that we have this desire to enrich the mind through good reading, then I think there are a certain number of very simple but general rules which we can remember and which will be of service. Namely, that reading, like eating, exercise, and work, must be consistent, must be regular, and must be neither over-excessive, must not be too much nor too little. The average person must learn how much reading it helps him and how much actually only obscures him or makes his thinking more difficult. The average person cannot read a sober text of serious import for a long time without fatigue. He is not supposed to. And reading to the exclusion of common activity will never be very profitable. It will produce the bookworm, but it will not produce the thinker. Therefore, we can say that the best way to read, the best way to study, is to set aside, according to the plan and need of living, certain times, a certain limited and restricted time that does not work a hardship upon the family or does not overbalance the well-being of the individual himself. Generally, in serious reading, a half hour is approximately the correct length of time. Because beyond a half hour, the individual, with only a printed page to inspire him, will lose acuteness of function. If he is highly trained and has perhaps advanced already a long way in the subject, he might be able to hold out for an hour. But that is just about his maximum. As a beginner, 15 minutes may take all that he can really do. And after that, he is only reading words. They may interest him a little, but he has passed beyond the vital power to experience them the moment reading fatigue sets in. So we generally recommend that a person who wants to be a fairly good student, but with a busy life in other fields in which he must make his living and meet his responsibilities, should, if situations permit, set aside approximately a half hour, if possible daily. If this is not possible, at regular intervals, perhaps at the weekend, or whatever time is most suitable. And that if his opportunities are highly restricted, so that perhaps only on Saturday or Sunday can he do these things, then it would be advisable for him to take two periods at this time, broken in some way. For instance, a half hour in the morning, a half hour in the evening. Do not, however, overdo it. Leave the intellectual table as you would the physical table, still hungry. And recognize that during the intervals in which you are not studying, you may be subconsciously working with what you have studied. Also, if you are studying a long and complicated work, break when you come to an important idea. Do not try to carry two new important ideas at one time. If it seems that you have reached a critical point, a high point, in the reasoning of this individual that you are reading, in which many valuable ideas have come together to form a focus of basic concept, pause there. Think about it. Reread it if necessary. Sometimes it is better to read the same paragraph every day for a week. Make sure that what you have found important, you are really gaining knowledge from. The moment you read a new idea, interpret it in terms of such experience as you can bring to bear upon it. How does your own life sustain this idea? How do your observations of other people sustain this idea? Is it workable in your own particular case? Is it workable in some other case that you know about? Is it according to approved working knowledge of persons who have achieved outstandingly in this idea or in this specialization? Always contemplation, so that reading should be accompanied by thoughtfulness. The good reader very often lowers his page, closes his eyes, and thinks about what he has read, thus giving himself a certain energy, a certain participation in the process of thinking. Normally speaking, it is not good to read two works relating to conflicting schools of thought at the same time. If you have finally digested one author, and you wish, in honesty, to say there must be another side to this, let's see what the opposite side has to say, then also give your full attention to the opposite side. Do not compare them page by page or concept by concept. Compare them in terms of total viewpoint. And after you have established the total equation upon which they are functioning, you can then decide which one is more suitable to you. It is not a case of which one is true or which one is untrue. The average person is simply not capable of that decision. The problem is it useful? Is it acceptable now? If not, hold it in suspension. Do not decide. Because tomorrow your own growth may change your attitude on many things. But having found that which meets need, use it. And if after the end of a considerable period of reading and study, you find you are the same person you were when you started, then something is wrong. You have not gained. You have not built. You have not become. Therefore, you are a word reader. You are simply taking the external of it. You're not getting into it and making it your own. This probably means haste, for one thing. Or it means that your own essential knowledge of the meaning of words is not adequate. Or it may mean carelessness or indifference, or the permitting of interruption to break into sequences of thought. Most likely, it is because you have not taken these pauses for consideration. You have gone on reading, hoping that you are going to grasp the secret of the ages, and you have not paused to contemplate, step by step, the meaning of things. The greatest experience in the reading of a highly systematized work of a great thinker, like Plato or even Aristotle, or one of the basic philosophers of the world, Immanuel Kant, or perhaps one of the greater Oriental philosophers like Confucius or Buddha, the great experience is the unfoldment of the continuity, because step by step they should lead you from what is obvious to that which is not quite so obvious, but which becomes more obvious under consideration. Until by degrees you have disciplined your mind in a pattern. You have not learned nearly what to think. You have learned how to unfold an idea in sequence. And the most valuable lesson you may learn from a complicated study is methodology, the orderly consideration of the unfoldment of ideas. This orderly arrangement will induce you to an orderly course in the consideration of your own problems. It will help you to attack something necessary in an orderly, sequential, reasonable manner. If you jump over too many of the intermediate processes in ideas, you will lose continuity and ultimately may come to an erroneous conclusion with no way to correct yourself. But if you consistently unfold the idea in its reasonable and natural manner, step by step, you will ultimately realize why the author, why the philosopher came to this conclusion, or if you feel that his judgment is wrong, you will have a particular and definite way of knowing why you think it is wrong. And your own thinking may be very vital on that problem. But it must be your own thinking and not merely opinion. It must be because you have traced the procedure in a sequential manner. Thus reading, when you really want to learn that way, is not an easy problem. It is not a substitute for going to school. It is not the quick way of doing something. But it is a highly rewarding way, because it escapes from mass educational procedure, which is always slow and awkward. And the individual can become his own teacher to a great degree, can make the assignments as a professor would make them, solve these assignments, prepare his thesis, do everything that he would do in an institution of learning. He will also learn how to document, to prove, to integrate, and to organize his own concepts. He may not need this documentation for himself, but if in turn he should wish to try to convey knowledge to another, the conveying of knowledge is just an exact science as the learning of it. And many persons are very unhappy and frustrated in this world because others will not accept or understand them. This is largely due to lack of organized conveyance. The individual has not recognized how to build a logical case for his own idea, has not presented step by step the facts in a manner in which they could be accepted by another person. When we burst a total concept on another uninitiated individual, we demand from them only one thing: flat acceptance or flat rejection. And if the individual is at all in trouble, which is usually the case, or we wouldn't help him, his condition of mind is such that the flat rejection is most likely. Or if the flat acceptance is given, it is given without meaning and without purpose and leads to no action. If, however, instead of demanding that people shall agree with us or disagree with us, which is the poor man's way of attempting to do a good deed, the right problem is to so possess our ideas, or be so possessed by them, that we can unfold them sequentially, convincing reasonable minds of the reasonableness of our own position. And if we do this, our power to assist others is greatly enhanced. And we discover that our opinions and beliefs and attitudes are given more weight, because it is obvious that we are master of them, that we have arrived at them by intent and not by accident, and in a sense that we possess ideas and are not merely obsessed by them. By such procedure, our ability to communicate is therefore strengthened and enriched. And we make another important discovery, that never do we learn as fast as when we are communicating. A matter and material which has not been clear to us, perhaps, in its totality, becomes increasingly clear when we tell it to another. Thus we find resources within ourselves. Reading should therefore teach us that there are some books which we enjoy reading and we get something from them. And there are others that are very difficult and sometimes we give them up in despair. Let us imagine now that we ourselves are like these books and passing on our ideas to others. Some of us can present ideas in a likable, acceptable manner because we are clear, concise, and orderly. Others of us cannot do this because by the time we have told our story, it is so difficult, so dismal, and so depressing in the method of communication that no one wants it. Yet we might have some truth in it if we could present it in a proper and reasonable and factual manner. Thus, reading helps us to talk. It helps us to speak. It helps us to convey thought onto others. It is a gradual instruction in the total concept of communication. And not only must others communicate with us with reasonable hope of honesty on our part, but we must also communicate with others with a reasonable hope of being understood. This means simplification, clarification, organization. And through study, we gain facility in these things. Thus, we learn not only just to find an immediate answer to an immediate question. We learn in order to get a total concept of a total need in life. And when we approach it this way, we become better students. And we also are truer to the great sources of inspiration, the great scriptural writings, the foundation works of our race, upon which we so greatly depend for our inspiration and our understanding. Thus we honor our author when we read him wisely. And we honor our gods when we unfold the consciousness within ourselves through orderly disciplines. And reading can be such a discipline. In fact, it is more important to learn how to read than the very content of the thing we read. It is much more important for us to have this vital ability to put life back into symbols, to make them living monuments to ideas, so that each word that we read immediately comes alive and becomes meaningful as a phase of consciousness. Working in this way and to this end, the combination of the mind and the book will result in the creation, the generation of living ideas. But if this generation is frustrated by an inapt or inadequate union, we then do not have the vital consequence which we most desire. Therefore, read thoughtfully, read carefully, read wisely and read lovingly, and at the same time, patiently, realizing that we grow quietly and slowly, and that each step must be surely taken. And by so pursuing our way, we discover ultimately that we are teachers because we can communicate in an orderly manner those ideas which have become living facts within our own consciousness. Thus, we are capable of making an individual contribution, and we are also capable of perpetuating the great contributions which we so deeply admire and about which we have so positive a spirit of living veneration. Well, time's up.